joining us this week for the first time. This is a workshop that's going to be going on for the next several months. And it's a workshop which is a repeat workshop from a workshop that Chris and Peter M. did up in Vermont at the Wilson House. And last week we started off with Peter M. And this week we are fortunate enough to have Chris. So I'll turn the meeting over to Chris.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. It's really nice to be here. Thank you all for coming. Thank you, Bill, for doing the taping and the sound. It's near impossible to hear in this room without some type of sound system. The acoustics are just bizarrely whacked out. So we really do appreciate it when he comes in with his sound. I want to thank Peter, who's not here tonight, for agreeing to do this, both at the Wilson House and here in Burnersville. I had a lot of fun at that workshop. The topic tonight is my experience finding recovery in the fellowship. As probably so many times with workshops like this, you end up preaching to the choir. The people that need to hear this stuff are usually not the ones that are in the rooms. But sobriety and recovery are really two different things. The way I define it is sobriety is staying away from alcohol, staying separated from alcohol. But if you're anything like me, just staying separated from alcohol becomes untenable after a period of time. My emotional state can't take sobriety for long periods of time without some type of recovery. Let me start at the beginning with my story. I was doing an inventory several years ago, and one of the instructions in that inventory with the person that I was going through with the steps with at the time asked me to, in my fear inventory, to go back to the earliest recollection of every single fear I inventoried. And I remember going back, my fear of people. One of the promises is fear of people will disappear, and it has for me. Which is a great thing, but I used to be completely repressed by crowds or having to do any kind of public speaking. It was crippling for me. It was so emotionally painful. But anyway, my first and earliest recollection was being dropped off for kindergarten as a kid. I hadn't gotten out much on my own at this period of time, you know. So I wasn't really used to being tossed out of the car. And I remember my mother opening the door and saying, you know, there's the building, there's your class, see you later. And I remember standing up on the hill, looking down, and there's kids running around playing tag and kickball, and they're already having a blast together. You know, they've already integrated. And I remember standing up on the hill looking and just feeling like a moron, you know, feeling like, how am I going to do this? How am I going to go down there and be friends with all these people? What if they don't like me? You know, what if I get in a fight? What if I do something stupid and they mock me out the rest of my life, you know? What if I get ostracized? I'm thinking like all this stuff. I'm five. And I know right away that there's something wrong with me because all these kids are having a blast. They obviously don't have that same self-centered fear that I have. And I remember from that moment on, I had to start acting as if everything was okay. Does anybody in here remember acting as if everything's okay? And inside, you're just falling apart. So I began my educational experience pretending I wasn't flipped out and trying to do the things that I thought I needed to do to get along and to not be made an outcast. My problem at that time was, well, let me tell you what the solution to that, for that kindergartner would have been. A couple of shots of whiskey, and I would have been the kindergarten kid. You know what I'm saying? I'd have been able to step out. And the thing was, is they weren't serving five-year-olds whiskey in kindergarten in those days. I don't know if they've become more progressive. But they certainly weren't doing it when I was there. that would have been a solution. It might not have been a functional solution, but it would have been a solution for me. Because here's what happened. For the next, I guess it was 7 years, I had to act as if I was okay. And I wasn't suffering from anxiety and everything else. And one day, a couple of my friends and I decided to cut school, go home to my house, take a bottle of whiskey down and get drunk. You know, none of us had ever gotten drunk before. It sounded like a cool thing to do. It was better than, you know, rolling hubcaps down the road or whatever you did at like 12 years old. So we went down, we went to my house, and I remember pulling a bottle of Four Roses whiskey out of the closet. Now, I don't come from an alcoholic family. I certainly feel for the people in this room that come from those hellacious, dysfunctional alcoholic family. I grew up in a Cape Cod house in Basking Ridge, a mother, a father, a sister, a brother, you know, like everything was calm, you know, there was no arguments, everything was, it was just like typical boring suburbia. So where did my alcoholism come from? I don't even really care about that answer today. But I will tell you that after I blew the dust off of that bottle and brought it out, I didn't know anything about drinking at that time, except for what I'd seen in John Wayne movies. You remember the John Wayne movies where he'd bust through the saloon door, he'd go up and he'd go, "Bartender, whiskey." And the bartender would get like a dirty water glass and a bottle of whiskey and fill it up, and John would just shoot that whole glass down, grab the bottle, and go back to the table to play cards or whatever. So I guess that's how you drink. So I filled up these three water glasses with warm Four Roses Canadian whiskey. Oh, my God. I mean, I didn't know anything about ice or mixers or letting it breathe. So I started drinking, and my buddies started drinking. Now, we had two completely different reactions to alcohol. Here's what happened to them. They had about two-thirds of their glass, and they'd had enough. You ever drink with people that have enough? Is that the most obnoxious thing in the world? "Sorry, I've had two. Going home to the wife. You know, got to have dinner." You crazy? Let's go to the city. You know, I mean, that's how I drank. I always wanted more from alcohol. You're going home, you know? So, but that's really what they did. They had two-thirds of the glass, and they'd had enough. I drank my glass, what was left of their glass, and as much of the rest of the bottle as I could, and I went into a blackout. It was my first experience with a blackout. Those are fun, aren't they? A whole section of time disappears on you where you don't know what you did or you know. You can do some crazy things in blackouts, like travel. You know, you ever wake up like in Topeka with one shoe, you know, wondering what the hell you're doing there? And of course, you got to act like you wanted to be there because you can't look stupid. But anyway, I had a blackout and I trashed the house. I made a complete fool of myself and I passed out in the field. I remember waking up in a field and having one of those just nuclear hangovers, you know, where you have to stay horizontal for like 2 days, you know, like you're just poisoned, you know what I mean? And here I am, I'm 12 or 13, and it made me unbelievably ill. But I slowly started to forget how ill alcohol made me, and I started to remember what it did for me. Somewhere down toward the bottom of that first glass of whiskey, that scared kindergartner, I was trapped with in bondage to that scared kindergartner. Well, that disappeared. This alcohol freed me from that. All of a sudden, all the fear, all the anxiety, all the self-esteem issues, all that stuff disappeared. And I was larger than life. I was the funniest guy. I was worth being around. Hell, there were dancing lessons in that Four Roses whiskey. You know what I mean? I felt like I thought all of you felt all the time, you know, when you were running around playing tag and kickball. I mean, I thought I had found a solution to my social problems that I was having, my assimilation problems. So, I didn't start drinking every single day, but I started to become preoccupied with alcohol. I started to think about where I was going to get it, who I was going to drink it with. I was like 13, and the drinking age was 21, so there was some logistical things that had to be surmounted. But, you know, the alcoholic is very resourceful, and I managed to always get alcohol when I wanted it. And I come from a very smart family. My brother and sister are both PhD college professors. You know, my mother and father were both Phi Beta Kappa educators and just way overeducated beyond their intelligence. And and as I start drinking, my academics start to slip. You know what I mean? It's just not that important to get good grades. I'm worried about where I'm going to go and who I'm going to be drinking with and all that stuff. So I ended up graduating high school the second stupidest kid in the graduating class. You got to work for that. That's like a D minus minus. You got to be careful not to slip too low. But I got out of there. And the whole time that somewhere along the line, my drinking went from preoccupation, which was I was interested in doing it, and I was planning on doing it, and I was beer and wine instead of the Four Roses, and every once in a while vodka, and you know, it started to become a part of my life. And it talks in the book Alcoholics Anonymous about crossing a line, and it says a lot of times you cross the line before you really want to stop. And what the line is the line, I believe, is the difference between being preoccupied and being obsessed with alcohol. And I slipped into the obsession of the mind. And really what that is now I'm hooked so deep into alcohol, my own unaided will is not enough to overcome it. I can manage short periods of sobriety, but I always put alcohol back in my body. And somewhere I crossed that line, and that's where I became seriously, actively alcoholic. I believe it was somewhere in high school, but I don't know. Anyway, here I am. I'm an alcoholic, and as we all know, alcoholism is progressive. It gets worse over any given period of time, and it did for me. It did. It's slowly, though. I mean, if it would have happened overnight, it would have caught my attention, but it's slow and it's almost imperceptible. You get worse and worse as the years go by, and you hardly notice it because that's the way you're used to living. And in the beginning, I had a lot of fun with drinking. I mean, you remember the high school parties where the rock and roll is on, and there's fights and people drinking, and people crashing cars, and you're just having a good time. I mean, I don't know about anybody in here, but I come from a period of time where friends let friends drive drunk, And those were the early 70s, and that's just the way it was. I totaled 9 cars in drunken blackouts. Could you imagine doing that today? You'd be in like maximum security or something. They say, "Let me go." Oh, it's just Crash Schroeder again, But I was always the final owner of every vehicle I ever had. I got sober and it was time to sell a car. I didn't even know how to do it. You mean I got to sign a title? What is that? I didn't know, but because they always were, the cops had them towed away every time. But anyway, I wasn't really paying a big price. I was having a lot of fun. And slowly I had some fun, and then I started to pay some prices. One of the car accidents I got killed in, I went through a telephone pole, and when the police got there, they had to bring me back with CPR and the shock paddles, clear. And I went out again in the ambulance, and this is so alcoholic. Listen to this. I mean, I have just been killed and brought back to life from drinking and driving. Guess what I did the day I got released from the hospital? With bandages on my head, my ribs taped up. I went to the liquor store, got 2 6 packs of beer, drove down to the park and started drinking, waiting for everybody to show up. I mean, it didn't even cross my mind that there was a pathological problem, I was very much caught in. And as alcoholics, we all know we'll do anything to protect our alcohol consumption. We lose families that we love very, very much to protect our alcohol consumption. It truly is a type of insanity. Now, I'll skip ahead to get to the topic, but I will tell you about my last drunk. I mean, I'd gotten worse and worse and worse, and I'd started a family, had a child, lost that family. I'd lost about 10 or so jobs. I became near unemployable, really just living a pathetic life. I was living in a room in my mother's house, and she just didn't have it in her to throw me out on the streets like she should have. You know what I mean? And here I was up in that room having a relationship with the bottle. You ever talk to the bottle? You know, it's just you and me, kid. You know, nobody understands us. You know, we're just too special for this world, you know, and just having that relationship with the bottle. And meanwhile, you know, my life has just gotten more and more and more pathetic. I wasn't really allowed to see my daughter. It got really bad. And the final straw was, I was an electrician. I became an electrician somewhere in this mix. You know, can you imagine? You know, me showing up after drinking like a quart of whiskey. I'm here to wire your house, you know? Oh, my God, who's that? His hair is sticking straight up, you know? Where'd you get this guy? I did stuff like drill down from the attic into people's closets and pull their part of their suits up into the ceiling, you know? I mean, one time I wired a kitchen addition to the wrong panel, and it was a timer panel for the hot water heater, so the kitchen would come on at 8 o'clock at night and go off at 6 in the morning, you know? People called up my boss and said, listen, we eat at 6. This is unacceptable. I could go on and on and on. I was a menace, and I'm looking at Bob here. I wired half of his house, and he's like, he's wondering when he caught me in my career, you know. My life had gotten very, 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 very pathetic. And this one day, I remember this kid Tony was my boss. He was 19 years old. I'm 33. And the boss puts Tony, the 19-year-old kid, in charge of me at work. I mean, that's how much confidence he had in me, you know? It was a good day if I didn't lose the van or something, you know? So anyway, this one day I'm putting a ground screw in a ceiling fixture box, and I'm shaking so bad from the night before, I keep dropping the screw. And I've got the screwdriver, and I keep dropping the screw. And I look over, and he's looking at me. He's looking at me like, and when you're alcoholic and you're detoxing, you can hear people think at you. You know what I'm saying? And I knew exactly what he was thinking. He was thinking, you pathetic, good for nothing, sorry ass, no account. And I couldn't take that. I mean, I'd lost a family. I'd gone through the front window of a car, the passenger window of a car. I got thrown out of the back window of a car one time. Got back in and tried to drive home. I had 3 flat tires. The car was bent like a boomerang. There was no windows left in the car. It could go about a mile and a half an hour. And I'm going home. I'm in Pittstown. I've only got 27 miles to go. You know? The cops get me. Where are you going? Home. Where was the accident? What accident? I've got glass sticking out of my head. You know? There's no accident. Have you been drinking? I had 2. I had 2 beers. Just 2. I'll tell you what. If you admit to more than 2 beers, you're not an alcoholic. That's not in the big book, but it should be. It should be right there in the chapter to wives. You know what I mean? Does your husband admit to only drinking 2 beers? Check him in. Anyway, so he's looking at me, and I just can't take it. I mean, I feel such shame. So that night I get drunk, and I call up, and I sign myself into a rehab. It's a rehab that's kind of defunct, so I can talk bad about it. It was the one down there in Morristown, and I sign myself in for the 28 days. And what was unusual about me being in there was I really was the only person that wasn't remanded in there. I mean, I was not, I was not in there because of a DWI. I was not in there because of an intervention. I wasn't in there because of a judge. And I really was the only person in there that, like, volunteered to go in. And you know how alcoholics are. I thought I was better than you because I admitted I was sick or something, you know how we are. Like, we can think that because we're worse, we're better. You know, well, I crashed 10 cars, you know. So anyway, I had the alcoholic ego going on. But I go in there and they start to do their thing, as rehabs will. And I can remember some of it, not a lot of it. I remember getting a big book and reading it kind of like a novel. And the only experience I had with it, reading it like it was the Da Vinci Code or something, was that every once in a while I'd go, ooh, you know, that happens to me. And that was my first exposure and experience to the book. I had a little bit of identification going on. But basically they had a lot of strange ways of helping you, of treating your alcoholism. I remember group. Anybody in here ever go to group, like in rehab or aftercare or anything? You sit around in a circle and you talk about your stuff. And they're calling on people, or they're going around the circle, and you know what? You're thinking to yourself, why doesn't that son of a bitch shut up? I want to talk. You know, he's hogging the time. And I would just think that, why don't you drink? You know, I'd think it for these people. And and finally they would get to me, and I could talk about my stuff. And today I understand why there's really bad discussion meetings and where that comes from. You know what I'm saying? Let me tell you about Aunt Fanny and Uncle Fudd and you know, the uppity tennis pro, you know, I mean, where that stuff never, ever helped me. I've got to tell you, it just kind of separated me because it gave me a lot of stuff to say. I am not like you, you know. So anyway, there were some other things that they did. I remember wallet making class. That was special. I think I still have that wallet. The stitches are a little off, you know what I mean? I remember they asked me to write my life story. I got to do a life story, and then I got to present it in front of my group sitting on the hot seat. You might as well have put a dunce cap on me, you know what I mean? And I remember reading my life story. Now, the thing is I pulled it out not too long ago. I was throwing away some stuff, and I found it. I had about 40 pages of stuff on, like, one page. My writing was, like, an eighth of an inch. I crammed all this stuff. It was so, I mean, I must have been so mentally ill at this time. And they want me to do a life story. So, you know, oh, God. I couldn't read it, you know, but all of these things really had little or nothing to do with any kind of recovery, I found out later. But I went through it. What it did was it separated me from the booze for 28 days, and it gave me some knowledge about alcoholism. And I got to watch the Father Martin movies, which I got to tell you, you know, my first inventory number, you know, resentment number one, Father Martin, you know. Good God, I had to watch so many of those Chalk Talk movies. I wanted to just jump through the projector and strangle that guy. I was a long way from serenity and peace of mind at that time, Dave. Anyway, get out of rehab. And listen, I am serious about this separating from alcohol stuff. I'm really, really serious. I signed myself into a rehab. Okay? After the rehab, they suggested aftercare. So I'm going and I'm paying like $65 a night, two nights a week, to listen to the muttonheads talk about their stuff in a group, waiting for my turn to share. That's how serious I was about separating from alcohol. I thought that's what I was supposed to do, and that's how I was supposed to do this thing. And they suggested two AA meetings. And I went to two Basking Ridge meetings, a Monday and a Wednesday night Basking Ridge meeting. But I got to tell you, I thought going there and sitting in the chair was going to do the trick. Here's what I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was like, and here's what I thought alcoholism was. I thought alcoholism was forgetting how bad alcohol is treating you. And if you could only remember how bad alcohol treats you, you won't drink it anymore and you'll be fine. And what I thought AA was a pep rally. Yay, yay, we don't drink today. And I thought that when we were holding our hands saying the Lord's Prayer, it was like a football huddle, you know? All right, everybody, you know, we're going to get one day at a time. We're going to keep it simple. First things first. Okay, see you tomorrow. Break! You know? I mean, that's, see you back here tomorrow. And that's what I thought AA was. And one day, I was on my way to an AA meeting, and the thought crossed my mind that it had been almost 90 days since I'd been drunk. I don't even really remember what it's like to be drunk. And, you know, they're saying some things. I'm not really fitting into this AA subculture. You know what I should probably do? I should probably drink. I should buy a gallon of vodka, drink it, and it'll solve two problems that I have. One of them is remembering what it's like to be drunk. And the other is I'll feel so bad I'll push back into AA and I'll do everything that I need to do. So, in effect, I drank a gallon of vodka to improve my sobriety. Now, I didn't have a sponsor at that time. Now, imagine passing that one by a sponsor. You know, I got a plan. Anybody in here sponsor and you know, you've got the sponsors coming up to you and going, hey, I've got a plan. You know, like, okay, hold it right there. Tell us your plan. We need to know the plan, okay? Because you know as a sponsor that it's the worst plan in the world, and you're going to help them to modify that plan as a sponsor. So anyway, I got really drunk, and instead of rushing back to AA, as was my plan, I found it very, very difficult. As a matter of fact, I drank nonstop for 5 months, and my last drink was where it was Christmas at the Schroeders, 1989. My mother was there, brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, cats, you know, the whole thing. It was Christmas, so the stockings were hung by the chimney with care. And the Christmas tree was up, and there was candles and mistletoe and Yule tidings and everything. And I go into a drunken, raging blackout where I threaten all their lives. I'm going to kill all of you. I'm going to kill you. This is all your fault. And that wasn't really the festive type of atmosphere that they were all looking for. So, and they really didn't want to see me drink myself to death because this was a bad one. This was a bad tear. And so they picked up and they moved their Christmas to upstate New York. Thank you. I come out of this blackout and there's a pile of vodka bottles in the sink. I don't even remember buying. I mean, I must have been staggering because I used to buy a bottle at a time. Any smokers in here buy one pack at a time because you're going to quit tomorrow? You know, well, that was me with the booze. I should have been buying it by the tandem load, you know, to save money. But I'd always buy one bottle at a time. So I must have staggered uptown, 30 times buying these bottles. That must have been a pretty sight. But anyway, I come out of this blackout, and it's the jumping off point that it talks about in this book. I couldn't imagine living life without alcohol, but I couldn't imagine continuing to put it in my body. And I wished for the end. I remember saying a prayer, God, either kill me or allow me to get sober. I can't live like this one more day. I can't. This is more than a human being should be forced to endure. And after saying that prayer, that was the last drink, really. So I am certainly one that believes in prayer. Now, I started going to AA meetings. I would switch groups a lot because I would get a resentment against a person or persons. Anybody in here ever do that at a meeting? You ever say to yourself, that horse's ass is going to share. He's got his hand up. God damn it, I'm going to have to listen to that hypocritical bastard. You know, I can't believe it. And I guess nobody else in here has ever done that. I'm certainly unique. But anyway, I would have to change groups because I would resent myself out of a group. Because I had no tools. I hadn't been exposed to the steps yet. What I was doing was I was meeting dependent. And I'm not critical of that. I'm just saying, you know, some of us are meeting dependent before we can experience recovery. And that's a good thing. The bad thing is if you're stuck in meeting dependency and you're not exposed to recovery. You can suffer in these rooms. You can go insane in these rooms, going to a meeting a day for 8 years. You know, I mean, it happens. We chirp like squirrels without recovery if we're just trying to do it by not drinking. Anyway, so here I am. I'm in the groups. I'm going to well, I shouldn't name the groups, should I? If I'm going to be critical of them, Myersville, Millington, you know, places like that. And they're really more about sharing, you know, sharing. Let's share. Which again, you get a lot of wisdom teaching. You get a lot of good information, and there are really, really good people, and there's really, really good sobrieties in those meetings. The problem is if you're a sick alcoholic, it's going to be very difficult to pick out the good from the bad. You know, I listen to a lot of people who really didn't have a clue early on, and luckily I had a decent sponsor, and he would pull me out of the ditch quite often, but. Fact of the matter is I wasn't really being exposed to the steps. Back at this period of time, you could experience something like this. I remember asking in a meeting, in a step meeting, well, how exactly do you do the four step? Because I couldn't figure it out from the step book. I was just going to step meetings. I wasn't going to any big book meetings. I remember going, how exactly do you set about actually doing the four step? And I remember a guy going, kid, you do a four-step with a pencil. I'm like, well, thank you for that. I learned later on that he didn't have any idea how to do a four-step, or else he wouldn't have said something like that, you know. But so I got my pencil, and I opened up the step book, and somebody mentioned something about a big book and a big book. I opened that up, and, you know, and I tried to do a four-step. Because it was being suggested to me by a sponsor. That particular sponsor wasn't showing me how to do it. He was suggesting that I do it. So I put together this hodgepodge of stuff. What it was another attempt at putting together a life story. It was a list of dirty, rotten things that I had done that I had never told anybody. And it was a list of character defects that I had recognized in myself. Can you imagine a really sick alcoholic deciding all those things for himself? And I put it all together in this thing that I hid underneath the spare tire in the trunk of my car for like 3 months, you know, until I got a chance to do a fist step. And I went and I did a fist step. And, you know, I got a whole lot of relief. I got the relief from that exercise. It was confessional. It was not a four step. It was confessional. And I got the relief that you get from something that's confessional. And it gave me a shot in the arm. Now, I'm struggling. I've got to tell you, you know that scared kindergartner? He's all over me. I'm in AA. I'm going to anywhere from 7 to 12 meetings a week. Because I had times in between jobs. You know how that is when you're in early sobriety? You have those times between jobs. And you're going to noon meetings and night meetings. Well, I was doing that a little bit here and a little bit there. So I was going to a lot of meetings. Now, I was a secretary at this meeting. I was making coffee over there. I was a no-show GSR over here. Anybody take the no-show GSR position for a while? I said that at a group one time, and this DCM came up and just reamed me out. Oh, man. But that's I'm in District 18. What can I tell you? No-show GSR. So anyway, we've got something like 93 home groups, and there's like 2 GSRs or something when I was there. Anyway, not that we judge. But I'm doing all these things. I'm going to the rehab that I was at, and I'm picking up the rehab people and driving them to meetings. I mean, I'm doing everything I can do. I'm cooking shellfish at the rehab picnic until my eyes are sweating, you know, from the smoke. And I'm doing all these things that I really find uncomfortable because I'm really, really willing to stay separated from alcohol. I'm desperate to not put that stuff in my body again. Just tell me what to do. Now, I had this friend, Radio Shack Mike. A lot of people had nicknames back when I was getting sober. And in an inventory, I found out why. There was like Bummed Out Bob and Evangelical Andy and, you know, Radio Shack Mike, Fish Food Phil I realized one time why they had nicknames. It's because I was nicknaming them, you know? Radio Shack Mike hasn't worked at Radio Shack in 16 years. You know, he's still being called Radio Shack Mike. Anyway, Poor bastard. Did I ever make amends for that? I don't know. I better. Anyway, I'm doing everything that I'm being asked to do. But this guy, Radio Shack Mike's, he's one of those guys that listens to tapes. And he gave me a set of tapes from a couple of guys from Arkansas. Okay? I don't know about anybody else, but I hate people from Arkansas. I don't really mean that. I mean, this was my prejudice at that time. Arkansas? What is somebody from Arkansas going to teach me? People from New Jersey do more thinking before 9 o'clock than an Arkansasian does all day, for God's sake. You know, and I was really skeptical about these tapes because he had given me some tapes before. He gave me some affirmation tapes. They were tapes that said, repeat 50 times in front of a mirror until you actually believe it. Chris, you're a wonderful guy. So I tried it one time. And I'm like, Chris, you're a wonderful guy. Chris, you're a wonderful guy. Chris, you're a wonderful guy. Damn it. Throw the tape machine on the floor. I mean, I'm an alcoholic. Trying to treat alcoholism with affirmations is like trying to stop a semi with a cobweb. You know what I mean? But, so I was distrustful at this point in time. But I had a long ride to work. So I got the Joe and Charlie tapes out and I started to listen to them. And, I'm unrecovered at this time. I'm sober, but I have untreated alcoholism coming out my ears. So it's very, very difficult for me. You know, we do a set aside prayer at the beginning of this meeting. And that's not in the big book, but where that comes from is there's a number of places in the book Alcoholics Anonymous where it says things like we beg of you to lay aside any prejudices you may have. Several lifelong conceptions might need to be thrown out the window. Contempt prior to investigation can keep you in everlasting ignorance. There's areas in the book that really suggest that we need to become open-minded on certain things, spiritual matters. And the set-aside prayer, which is really, it's a living document. Each group can do it. I mean, it's not set in stone. Each group or each person is free to interpret it however they want to, but it's an important concept. And so I was slowly becoming open-minded with these Joe and Charlie tapes, and I started to listen to them. And the first resentment I got was this. This is the message that they gave me. Chris, you do not have a program. You're in the fellowship. All the things that you're doing is fellowship. And you're doing some kind of service, but you're certainly not carrying the message. You're bringing the boobies from the hatch to the meetings, but you're bringing them to the message. You're not carrying the message to them. And you don't have a program. All of the stuff you have is a fellowship. And you know what? The program is in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you don't follow the instructions in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't have an AA program. So when you drink, please don't tell anybody that AA didn't work because you did not work AA. And this was kind of the message that I got from this. Now, obviously, I got a resentment. Column number one, Joe and Charlie. Column number two, know-it-alls. How the hell do they know? But anyway, you know what I'm saying? But it haunted me. This message haunted me. I immediately threw it aside because the meetings I was going to at that time, nobody was pounding the big book who wasn't looked at like they were a circus clown or something. You know what I mean? There was a couple of guys coming into meetings and, somebody go, hey, there's what's his name and he's got the big book with him. Better stay away from him. I'm like, you're a leper or something. So there really wasn't anything like that going on at this time. But the message haunted me because the truth will haunt you as an alcoholic. Now, I was going through some rough times. There were some things that came up in my life that caused me a great deal of emotional stress. And I just knew I was getting very, very close to a drink. That alcoholic clock was ticking in me, and I just knew that I wasn't going to be able to take the emotional pain much longer. And what I did was I took these tapes back out. They'd been on the shelf for about 3 months while I was resenting them. I took them back off the shelf. I opened up the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started listening to these Joe and Charlie tapes, and I started to do the exercises. I started to do things the way they said to do it, very mechanically, not like, well, there's as many programs as there are people in AA. You know, you take it cafeteria style. The problem with cafeteria style is all I ever wanted was the brownie a la mode. You know what I mean? I didn't want the vegetables. So the thing that I did was I actually said, okay, you know, I'm going to try this. And I found out a number of things that were significant. That scared kindergartner that started to dissipate, those emotional feelings. Some of the promises, there are many, many promises in this book. Some of the promises really started to take place in my life. And I was sponsoring by this time because I gave good share. You know what I mean? You ever see somebody who's like, you know, their recovery is like in the toilet, but they're good to listen to? That was me. I gave good share. So sometimes the tugboats that blow the most steam pull the boats. So I had two or three sponsees, and they were drinking on me. You know what I mean? Making me look bad. You ever have sponsees drink on you? That's disconcerting. You know, somebody comes up to you in a meeting. Hey, is Henry yours? Do you know he's drinking? You know, he's drinking and he's borrowing money and, you know. What do you do? What do you say to that? So I'm being made to look bad. So I remember the first guy, Pat's in here. He was like the second or third guy. Where the hell's Pat? Like, yeah, he's lucky to be alive because he was a practice case. But anyway, this was like 1994, 95, and I was bringing people over to my house, and we were going through the book Alcoholics Anonymous, page by page, line by line, instruction by instruction. And you know what? You know what I found out? The people that went through that process, every one of them is still around. Not only that, every one of them is a member in Alcoholics Anonymous, in good standing. Their quality of life is out the roof, and they're all working with others. They all have sponsees, and they're all active carrying the message. Now, that's significant. That's what the recovery process can offer you. I normally don't do this. I will warn you, this is non-conference approved material. My God, you know, make a cross. This is a book called Slaying the Dragon. All right, what it is it's a history of alcoholism and drug treatment over the course of the last several hundred years. And I've got to tell you, there's nothing in this book, that showed any real signs of success until the 12-step process came on the horizon with the meeting of Dr. Bob and Bill. There were other religious organizations that had some temporary results with some spiritual programs, but there was nothing as significant as AA until this time. You know what some of the treatments for alcoholism were at the beginning of this century in the 20s and 30s? How about frontal lobe lobotomy? Okay? How about that? How about if your bottom was 60 years ago, they cut your forehead off and scooped out a part of your brain to keep you from drinking? How about that? There was unbelievable treatments for alcoholism. One of them, this is over in France in the 1800s. They would actually lock you up in these things. They looked like mummy cases, and there was like a little window with bars, and they would lock you up in these sarcophaguses and just shove food through to your face. And they knew that if they ever let you out, you would escape and go get drunk. So they kept you in these coffin-like structures. That was alcoholism treatment. You know how lucky we are to have Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12-step recovery program? Anyway, I am unbelievably grateful. Alcoholism is a progressively fatal illness. I'm not one of the people that call it a disease. I'm not going to argue with you that it is or it isn't a disease. It's a controversy, and I don't want to go near it. But it is an illness, and it is a malady, like it talks about in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's a progressively fatal illness. There's not too many progressively fatal illnesses that have the benefits to their recovery process that Alcoholics Anonymous does. You know, our quality of life increases all across the board if we engage in the 12-step recovery process. You really can't say that for a lot of other illnesses, cancers or any of the other illnesses. So I really think we're lucky. Anyway, a little bit more of my story. As I started to take people through the steps over at my house, a group of people kind of formed think it was Thursday night, and a lot of people were coming over, and we were all going through the book together. It started two or three people, it ended up six, eight people sometimes. And one of the individuals that went through the steps, here's how it happened. I knew his sponsor, and his sponsor was having a hard time with him. And his sponsor said, "Hey, Chris, would you take my sponsee through the steps? I know you got that thing going on over your house." So he sent him over to me, and we went through the steps. He got to an amends. There was like 93 amends he had on his amends list, and he just started knocking them all out. And anybody in here who's either experienced it or seen people experience that level of intensity with amends know that your whole life opens up. I mean, your whole spiritual life blossoms. He did 90-some of these amends, and his sponsor comes up to me and goes, "Chris, whatever the hell you did with that guy, would you do it with me too?" And I said, "Sure." And he starts coming over. Well, this individual knew a priest, and the priest was exposed to the recovery process. After this guy went through the steps, he got a job, he got his license back, you know, he got into a relationship and got married. A whole real lot of good things happened to this sponsor who went through the steps with me in a very short period of time. So this priest started asking questions, "What the hell happened?" "Well, I'm going through the steps with this guy named Chris." He goes, "Where can I find that guy?" And he goes, "Well, I hear he's speaking up in NetCon on Thursday." So that particular priest goes up, listens to me speak in NetCon, and after the meeting comes up to me and says, "Listen, whatever you're doing up in your room at your house, taking people through the steps, I want you to do that at my church. You can have any night. I don't care about rent. I want it to be part of my church's mission. Would you please do that?" I had some hesitation to that, because what it was I was reading from the big book, showing people the mechanics of recovery. Back in the early 90s, that really wasn't done. I mean, you would be a know-it-all, or, you know, who the hell is it? Chris is up there teaching people AA. Who the hell is this guy? So, I mean, I was worried. I knew I was going to get beat up. But I mean, what are you going to say? A priest comes up to you and says something to you. I mean, you know, I've gone through the steps. I know that there's some divine stuff going on in my life. So I agree to it. And that's where this meeting started. This meeting started back in very late 1997 downstairs. And it's become what it's become today. Now, one of the interesting phenomenons of North Jersey Alcoholics Anonymous is, somewhere around 10 or 12 years ago, there was very little big book recovery, very little fundamental go through the instructions in the book Alcoholics Anonymous recovery. It was more the oral tradition variety, where if you had a really good sponsor, he'd give you some wisdom teachings, he'd expose you to some exercises, and if you had a good sponsor, you'd probably be okay. If you had a horse's ass as a sponsor, you were in some real trouble. So this group, the Berkeley Heights group, one in Hackettstown, a couple of groups were instrumental in starting this kind of thing, where we really focus on the recovery. We really focus on the solution. It's not really a meeting where you share about your day. It's more about being exposed to the recovery process. And the pendulum has started to swing in North Jersey AA. There's a website where all the new meetings post their flyers. Has anybody seen that? Well, check it out. 4 out of 5, am I right, Bill? 4 out of 5 of those meetings are big book meetings. They're big book studies. They're big book presentation meetings. They're big book workshops. I mean, the pendulum is swinging. Now, what we're really hoping for, at least what I'm hoping for, is for there to be a balance. For anybody that comes into Alcoholics Anonymous to be able to be exposed to the really good recovery stuff, the stuff from the big book, and really good AA, because there's really good AA out there. There's good speaker meetings, there's good step meetings, there's good discussion meetings. So, you know, I really think that what's happening now is this renaissance with the big book and the recovery process that's really touched almost every group in New Jersey. I think what's going to happen is there's going to be a really healthy balance. You know, it's going to come out in the wash, and AA is going to be better for it. Your chances of staying sober and surviving going into Alcoholics Anonymous as a page 21 real alcoholic is going to be improved. And, you know, that's really really what I'm hoping for. No longer do I have to put on my resentment list those sons of bitches that don't have to do the work. Anybody in here ever have to do that? Those bastards that don't have to do the steps in the meetings. I don't have to put that in my first column anymore. I have come to peace with everybody and everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous and all the meetings. You know, I'm very, very grateful for that. I'm grateful for everybody that's here tonight. It's 9 o'clock. We've got 15 minutes. We can, anybody wants to share, anybody wants to ask questions, anybody wants to criticize or rebut, now is your chance. Thank you. Yes, we have a hand right there. Bill, you're going to have to help me out with that.
It's nnjaa.com.org. It's North New Jersey. It's the Area 44 website. If you go to, you know, group events or something like that.
Thanks, Bill. Yes, all the way in the back. Rob.
Hey, Rob.
Thanks, Ron. Yeah.
George. Repeat the question.
Yeah. The format for this meeting and what we have planned is basically what we're going to do is Peter's going to get a chance to go through steps 1 through 3, his experience. I'm going to get a chance the following week to go through 1 through 3. Then he or I will do steps 4 through 6, and we'll each take a week to do that. We'll each take a week to do 7 through 9. We'll each take a week to do 10 through 12. And then we have a real fun question and answer and wrap-up where we both sit up here at the table and, you know, take everybody's inventory. Bill sent out the actual dates and everything. You can
go to that website.
Yeah, you can go to the website and actually get it, I think. Yes, over there.
Thank you.
Well, certainly if you're alcoholic, you have a spiritual malady, and if that spiritual malady isn't treated, your spirit is going to grow sicker and sicker. Going to meetings and not drinking is not the treatment for alcoholism, okay? It's what it'll do is it'll create a temporary period of sobriety where if you're lucky enough, you'll be exposed to recovery. That's my look on it. There's also something that I didn't talk about, and I get a lot of criticism for this too, but I don't really care. There's a scale in alcoholism. It talks about it in a number of different places in the big book. In the chapter to wives, there's 1, 2, 3, and 4. And it says, no matter how far down the scale you have gone, you'll find that your experience can benefit others. And then there's another part in the book where it says your ability to stop drinking on your own unaided will is directly proportional to how far down this, how much control you have lost. So all of these things lead me to believe, all this information in the book Alcoholics Anonymous leads me to believe that some of us are sicker than others as far as our alcoholism is concerned. And I don't want to do this, but I'll do it. Let's trivialize it by saying number one is somebody that had a little bit too much wine at the church social and shows up at the Friday night meeting. And number 10 is the person that's been, you know, homeless and in rehabs and treatments and have 14 different sponsors and has really tried and never been able to get sober. Okay, so there's a scale of 1 to 10. I believe that the people from like 1 to 4 or 5 are okay with oral tradition AA. You know, there's a lot of people that come into AA and don't get involved in the book and don't sponsor people, and their lives get better. The only thing I can believe is they haven't gone down the scale that far. They're not as sick as I am. I got to tell you, if I don't do the whole deal, I'm somewhere around 8 or 9. I mean, I literally have to be medically detoxed when I pick up a drink. I mean, the whole 9 yards, I have delirium tremens. I see demons. There's animals running around. You know what I'm saying? It's not pretty. It's not pretty. I projectile vomit. I date Hell's Angels women. I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's just really, really ugly. And not that there's anything wrong with that. oh, God. Anyway, I'm obviously I'm kidding about certain things, but am I going to get out of this, Dave, or not? No. All right, I'm stuck. I'm in it. All right. I'm like an 8 or a 9. I've got to have the whole deal. I've got to have the spiritual awakening at depth. I've got to have that profound rearrangement of my attitudes and my ideas and my outlook and my actions. I really need the real deal to be able to survive. And most of the people that come up and say, Chris, will you sponsor me? Need the same thing because they've usually been through a lot of things and they haven't really been successful. So I don't know if that touches on your question at all, but that's kind of the way I see things. If you're a page 21 alcoholic, you don't have any choice, and you have to do this deal. Or at best, you're going to remain sobriety. You're going to remain sober and real cranky. You know what I mean? And your quality of life is going to really suck. So. So get involved in this, man. Get active. You know, there's a bunch of different kinds of drinkers. There's drinkers who, you know, you go into a bar, there's drinkers who will sit there and just kind of cry in their beer. There's drinkers that will get like amorous and, you know, try to get romantic. And then there's drinkers that will go, let's go to the city! You know what I mean? That's the kind of drinker I am. You gotta be like that mad dog in AA too, you know? Let's go to the big book, you know? I mean, you gotta be like that because I'm telling you, it is unacceptable for me to have anything except a really, really good time in this life. I may only get this one shot, you know? I mean, there's Buddhist and Hindu beliefs that you could come back a roof rabbit or something, but I'm not counting on that. I'm figuring that maybe I only got this one shot. I don't want to waste it. I want to have a really good time. And you get involved in the recovery process, and your whole life will open up, and you'll get 200 promises coming true, and you know it's worth it. Yes, Marty.
My question is that I know I'm not alcoholic, and in my heart, soul,
I think it's essential for each of us to be convinced of our first step truth. It's the first step truth that paints us into a corner and allows us nothing but a spiritual awakening as the treatment. Okay? So sometimes I can help somebody come to their truth by presenting the right questions, not necessarily the right answers, but the right questions. There's some exercises like the Bill Wilson exercise. Highlight everything in the first 8 pages that you relate to his drinking. There's the 4 categories in the chapter to wives. Have them look at that. Certainly the early chapters in the book, more about alcoholism and there's a solution, talk at length about the different individuals in there that, the jaywalker, the man about 30, Fred, all of those are examples of people who thought they could still control their alcoholism. Our hats are off to them if they can. If you find that you cannot stay separated from alcohol and your life is unmanageable, we have a solution for you. It's hard for me. Every once in a while, I'm successful at talking somebody into seeing their own problems when they're not yet ready, when they're not really willing. Sometimes you're successful at that, but I think for the people to get through the steps, and I'm more interested in working with somebody who's going to get through the steps today than I am interested in talking somebody into believing they're an alcoholic or talking them into joining my AA group. I'm really more interested that they get the recovery experience. And sometimes along the way, you find out that they're not alcoholic when you're working with them on the first step. That's happened to me 3 times. I've been working on the first step with people, and I found out 2 guys were drug addicts and had real no alcohol history at all, no problem with alcohol, and one guy was just a nut. And and I'm like, look, the psychopath anonymous meeting is down the road. Quit taking up a chair, I think that once you intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle you, you intuitively know how to handle the people that you're working with. Because I'll tell you, none of us are smart enough to say the things that we say to people when we're working with them. But we end up saying the right thing to the people who are ready and willing. Yes? Henry. Thank you. What do we got? A minute? Or two? Got time for one more? Yes, in the back. Basically, the question was, how do you handle somebody who's just a drug addict or may not look like they actually qualify for AA, and they're in AA, and you're working with them. It's a very controversial topic. I do want to say that it's up to each of us. I've made exceptions, and I've worked with drug addicts quite a few times and taken them through the steps, and I've found that I didn't get a lot of success with that. I really think if you're a drug addict, you should go through the steps with a drug addict. I mean, if I find a drug addict, there's many of the guys I sponsor are both drug addict and alcoholic. I'm not. When the time came to separate from drugs, I did it, and I didn't have to go to LSD Anonymous, Marijuana Anonymous. I mean, I was able to back away from them, when the time came. But there are a lot of people whose experience is different than that. I think that wherever we're going to be, if you're a drug addict and you choose to go into AA and identify yourself as an alcoholic, whatever. But I truly believe that you need to understand your own first step truth for you to have the power to go through the steps. And then you need to work with other people that have the same problem that you have. Today, when I get drug addicts that want to go through the steps with me, I'll send them to Pat. I'll send them to Ray. There's a lot of guys that I know. Not to point you out, Pat. I'll send them to people who have the right kind of experience. But I am not the AA police. I really don't kick anybody out. If you're working with me and we discover your truth, I'll tell you what I think you should do. But I don't make judgments. I can't see inside somebody's heart and really see what's really going on with them. So, you know, I don't want to point anybody out as you belong and you don't belong. That's really not for me. It looks like we are at the hour. Are we at the hour, Dave? Okay, we have a nice way of closing. Come back next week.